The problem of education is worrying most of us at the present time. I remember back around 1925, I was giving a series of lectures in San Francisco, and the principal of the Galileo High School invited me to address an assembly at the high school. And there was a discussion as to what the subject would be. And finally, it was decided to use the same subject that I had been giving in my own series of lectures, and that was a study of Nordic mythology, all about the gods of the Northlands and so on. We had a very good assembly, probably 90% of the student body was there, and I got an encore to come back for a second appearance, which also went off reasonably well, and the young people seemed to be tremendously interested. They were interested because the stories were dramatic, exciting, picturesque, and a little mythological. It was quite different from the rather conservative, basically monotonous type of education to which they had been exposed for a number of years. About 3 years ago, I was in San Francisco for a few days, and a white-haired lady came up to me, accompanied by a much younger woman. And she said, "You probably don't know who I am, but I heard your lecture at the Galileo High School nearly 50 years ago. I've never stopped talking about it, and I've told my daughter for years, and I'd like you to meet her also." So it was old time week, and in the discussion of the subject, the lady very kindly pointed out there was the only thing about Galileo High School she ever remembered. So this seems to be one of our problems today. The curriculum is as dull as is conceivable. It is following a system of instruction that began about the beginning of the 14th century. Here we had the great universities that were under the cloisters of the church. The great schools like the Sapienza and the University of Basel in Switzerland were monuments of dignity. The faculties were aristocratic in every sense of the word, and the students were regarded as little better than trash, no matter where they came from. The professors sat in large gilded chairs and thrones and instructed the students in pedantic Latin, Greek, and whatever else happened to be the subject of the day. There was nothing of interest, nothing vital, nothing really useful in most of the curriculum. When Paracelsus of Hohenheim attended the University of Basel's medical department, he observed one day in public that the small, fine hair on the back of his neck knew more about the practice of medicine than the entire faculty of Basel. This endeared him, of course, and not long afterwards he was assassinated, probably with the cooperation of the medical faculty. We are much in this same condition today. The actual method of instruction has varied very slightly in the last several hundred years. Of course, there are many things taught today that were not taught then. They did not know a great deal about modern scientific thinking or modern industrialism, but they could make very dull matter out of whatever they were teaching, and we are doing the same now with what we are teaching. Also, it seems to be very little effort on the part of formal education to prepare young people for the mystery of living. They may be able to take a job, which of course is important in our time, and many of them suffer for years through the educational system for one reason only, and that is to find employment. They do not expect to have any enrichment of character or development of moral overtones from the curriculum. So we have today young people pouring out of our various educational institutions with practically no contribution to make to the improvement of the society to which they belong. If they majored in astronomy, they can count some more stars and look into the depths of black holes, but they still have no capacity for personal living. They cannot make a success of family or home or personal life. In every branch of learning, it is more or less the same. It is sterile. I have talked to a number of young college and university people lately, and they all say that it is dead. There is nothing of interest, nothing to stimulate thought, nothing to cause the individual to feel that he was truly increasing his own knowledge. He is simply remembering what he's told. He follows the leader. If he doesn't follow, he is not likely to graduate at all. Many have dropped out simply because they couldn't learn anything they wanted to know. And it is a difficult and tragic matter for young people to graduate from a university or even a high school without any realization that they should not be in narcotics or something of this kind. We are in a very serious need of education. We are in need of the maturing of our mental lives. Most of all, we are in need of instruction which will teach us how to think. Now, in order to learn how to think, the individual must develop his own mental resources. But in most of the educational theories we have today, he is not taught how to think. He is simply told what to think. And he'd better agree. Also, of course, there are problems of advancement in knowledge, which the Sapienza and the great universities of Germany and France never knew. That's the football team. This is a very important social function. I heard a professor from one of the universities trying to defend the athletic side of the curriculum. He said it helps to build sportsmanship. And if you ever watch a football game, you'll see just what sportsmanship really is. It's a process of gradually slugging your way to victory. Also, sportsmanship has nothing to do with the ethics behind the football procedure. It is a discouraging disillusionment for young people to believe that the institution they belong to is supporting some of the things that happen in professional athletics. So there is practically nothing left. Surely the individual may get a job, but even that is becoming more difficult all the time. He may be able to gradually advance in some highly technical profession, but even in this type of advancement, there are serious handicaps. A completely contemporary doctor, for example, must go back and study again a certain amount of work every year as long as he practices because of the changes in medical procedure. Same is true in legal procedure. The same is true in science. The young people of today who are studying the computer are completely new in a field that is comparatively recent. In a few years, this will be antique. Something else will take its place, and the individual will have to be educated all over again. There just is not enough pattern and not enough planning. The educational system is not thinking through its own procedures. It is simply taken for granted that it is a peer group, that it will always be looked up to as the highest aspect of human culture. And then it will continue to do exactly what it has done for the last 700 years. What do we need then? We need something that will harness the capacities of a person, will make that person a more independent living being, a creature capable of personal decision, and also possessing the courage and moral stamina to maintain a high degree of individual conduct. These things are not even discussed in most schools unless they are seminarian. So today we are working with a very definite difficulty. Another problem that is confronting us is the cost of education. It is probably today more expensive than it can ever be worth. It forces families very often to forego the most important securities of life in order to educate children. And the education processes go on to infinity almost. I know a young man now who is still working for his doctorate. He is 39 years old and still going to school. He will probably graduate in time to retire. And at that time will go on Social Security. The education he received can serve him for only a few years. This is utterly unnecessary. In order to take up all this time, he learns many things that he never needs to know, or assembles a mass of opinions, beliefs, and doctrines that will never be of the slightest use to him in the problems of daily living. We are confronted, therefore, with a need, perhaps, for the reestablishment of an apprenticeship system in education. We need to have individuals educated for their jobs by persons who know the job. And they should learn by doing, and not by sitting in the back of an immense class, as one man that I know has done, where it was necessary for him to use binoculars to see the blackboard. This type of thing produces not thinkers, but cut-out characters in streams and strings of people who are not able to face the emergencies of life with anything resembling dignity. Now, the apprenticeship system would be very economical for all concerned and very useful. For one thing, the individual would learn comparatively without cost to the family. Small cost, perhaps, but nothing in comparison to sending that same young person through a university course. Instead of going to school to learn something he will never use, he has the right to select that which he believes he wishes to do and learn how to do it from people who are doing it, instead of people who are reading it out of a textbook. I know a professor of architecture, or did years ago, he's gone now to his blessed reward, who originally was a teacher of Greek. And because nobody in the university where he lived had any use for Greek scholars, he switched over to architecture. He had about a year in architecture when he took the class over, and for the rest of his service was 1 year ahead of his students. During his entire course and afterwards, he never built a house. All theory, no practice. Now, some do better than this, there's no question about it. But there's also no doubt that there's a tremendous amount of wasted time, wasted money, and more than that, crippling of the potentials of the person. We are concerned with the right of the individual to grow. Now, another aspect of this same situation, of course, is the rapidity of procedure that is constantly adding to the cost of education. There is absolutely no excuse for the present use of vivisection as it is now used in medical colleges. If it is necessary for something of that kind to be done, it can be done once on film and shown to all the other schools. The idea that each one has to go through it himself is a completely devastating thing, and a great many are being offended so seriously they are leaving the colleges because they do not want to participate in torturing animals. If it has to be done, one university can do it, and all the others can simply watch the film. And this is true in many other fields where the personal experience problem is not important in the sense that it's an observational procedure and can be observed off of good film just as well as in any other way. Also, in the various procedures of scientific training, we used to have what might be called the belles lettres or the humanities. We had courses for individuals who did not know why they were going to the university. They were going because their parents, friends, relatives, and so forth thought they should. Also, they were going for social contacts and the hope of either a better marriage or a more fortunate circle of acquaintances. This type of education is now practically defunct. Any family that tries to do this is simply wasting money. And the individual has no real value or advantage unless he at least went for a reason and for a purpose that was important to all concerned. From the very beginning of time, we watch the gradual change in educational procedures. Way back in the dawn of culture and civilization, education was almost completely a matter of association. It was a matter of the individual being with others of his own kind. When Socrates gave one of his discourses, he first prayed to the spirits of the place and then told his disciples what he thought they ought to know. It was then open to questions and discussions, and the teacher became a kind of parent, a godfather, a wisdom teacher over the lives of his disciples. In the Orient, it was a group of novices sitting under a tree with a guru, learning and studying the things that made life important to them. Everywhere in antiquity, education was largely a family affair or a community affair. If the individual wished to go further than this, if he wanted his education to go on to higher things, and he might, he then generally applied to the state for initiation into the rites and mysteries of religion. The state religion and the esoteric schools which accompanied it were the source of higher education. And the theory behind this was very simple. The young person was told by his family or by his local teacher who had worked with him that the purpose of higher education was to become more useful to society, and that therefore all higher knowledge had to be dedicated to the service of God and humanity. There was to be no consideration of going through the esoteric schools in order to get a larger salary or hold public office. All increase of knowledge had to be dedicated to human need. And this human need was usually provided financially by the state. These schools were supported by the community. The instructors received very little or practically no compensation other than living. The disciples and students expected nothing more than that. They hoped that they would be able to go out and contribute to the common good. As a result of that, all higher education had an over-religious content. It was not assumed that anyone could use an education safely if he was an atheist. If he was not enlightened internally, if he was not dedicated to the need of humanity and graduated for the purpose of getting rich, he did not deserve an education, and the community that supported this type of learning would itself crumble. All knowledge is dominated by dedication. It is for a reason. It is for a common good. It is for a usefulness, not that the individual shall carve out a competitive career. As a result of this older system, nearly all of the countries of antiquity had at least a group of highly specialized thinkers. Now, these persons were not always recognized, and they were seldom rewarded, that is true. But reward was not the principle involved. They were there to counsel with those who sought knowledge. And in most of the governments of antiquity, what we would call the prime minister was the one who was the oracle of the gods. The oracles of antiquity ruled the state. The state was dominated by a concept of deity. Occasionally, some tyrant, a highly ambitious person, went over the traces and tried to do it his way. In a short time, he vanished because of the abuse of his own powers. So the purpose of education was to discover not only more knowledge, but to realize the responsibility of knowledge. That the most serious dishonesty that's possible is religious and philosophical dishonesty. An individual who wants to use what he knows simply and entirely for his own benefit belongs to a group that could ultimately destroy the state. There has to be dedications. Now, what are the dedications that the ancients knew? The dedications to deity. The belief that this universe was a moral structure, that it had laws and rules, that these laws and rules were just, and education consisted of finding out what these rules were and gaining the interior dedication to keep these rules and to understand why they must be kept. An educated person, therefore, was one who knew why honesty was essential to survival. If you didn't know these things, you wasn't educated. Education also involved the realization of the common need. Every educated person must share what he knows, but most of all, he must share part of himself, which he has trained to various duties and responsibilities. He can become a teacher of the young. He can become a friend of the older. He can become a servant of the state. But in every form of function, he must be using what he knows for a common good beyond himself. He cannot simply hide his knowledge so that other people can't have it and therefore cannot compete with him. It is the duty of the wise person to make others as wise as possible. It is the normal responsibility of the selfish, self-centered person to keep other people as ignorant as possible so that he can control them. Now, we have all kinds of situations like this rising around us in these difficult days, but we must come around finally to the realization that education, taking up, as it does, nearly a third of the life of the human being, should prepare him for something. At least it should make him a constructive citizen in his own community. It should make him capable of some moral decisions which are advantageous to other people. It must help him to live a kind of life that protects his family, that protects his children, and provides those around him with an example of right conduct. The individual, therefore, is educated who accepts the responsibility for his own conduct and realizes that this conduct is very essential to the survival not only of himself, but of the world in which he lives. So we can ask ourselves simply, how many graduating from the great institutions of the modern world graduate as persons dedicated to the service of others? How many realize the nature of laws as they are in the universe? How many have discovered the integrities of life? How many have been able to study just a little bit the way in which animals are educated, in which the family educates the child, in which the parent shows the way and leads the way? Comenius, the great Moravian educator, one of the founders of our public school system, talked about the mother school, where the child learned the first important lessons of life at his mother's knee. being told and shown the way of integrities, being given in time and attention and thought necessary to producing a constructive citizen. There is, of course, still a group that does this type of thing, but it is too small. For the majority, the individual is left to his own resources. The parents expect the school to educate him. The school knows it can't, so the school hopes the church might, and then makes very definite and evident that the church doesn't count in the secular life of society. Well, this type of problem leaves everyone in a state of complete confusion. Now, assuming that we have come through this confusion for a number of years and are still in a state of bewilderment as to the proper conduct and the proper way of improving our own natures, it may be that some individuals will have to wait and receive their education in the last few days of life. It may be. I always like that Greek story, which I guess I've told several times, but it will bear repetition today, about the old gentleman in the back room of the house in Athens who was on his deathbed, and the neighbors had all gathered in the front room to gossip and so forth until he left. And someone happened to look into the back room, and the old gentleman was sitting up on the couch with his hand behind his ear, listening intently. One of them said to him, "Father, why are you listening? You're not going to be here long." And the old man said, "Well, I'm here now, and as long as I'm here, I can learn something." And too many people today are convinced that no matter how long they live, they're not going to learn anything. And this has to be gradually changed by a different approach to knowledge. Each person should perhaps classify a series of factors within his own nature which would have some bearing upon him. In the first place, perhaps he should say, "What did I always want to be? Am I doing the thing I really want to do? Have I sacrificed everything for a salary? Have I given up all my own hopes and aspirations because I'm completely disillusioned? Am I stuck in this rut because my responsibilities will not let me get out of it?" There are all kinds of motivations behind the individual when he begins to study his own life. But there's one point that might be always useful to him. He may graduate from his career when he reaches retirement age. Then what he has or what he is able to accumulate becomes the basis of freedom, of leisure. He may or may not feel able to take on another job. He might do a little something here and there. But for this person to simply sit down in front of a television for the rest of his life is a tragic mistake, because it is in these years in which he is no longer being pushed by other circumstances that the time has come for him to push himself, to get at the things that might improve his way of life. He can realize that he is not simply here to waste time. He is here to use time as best he can. Over a long, difficult period of employment, he has had very little time. And he has had even less because of the demands of family and the emergencies that have arisen along the way. But now he has some time. In fact, we all have some. It has been estimated in this country that the average person spends about 4 to 6 hours a day in front of television. Well, if this energy was used for something constructive, it might change the course of empire. But it is simply being wasted. And yet, as in the case of education, the various people who are actually watching are most of them completely disillusioned with the programs they are seeing. They're unhappy, they're unsound in their own thinking about this matter. So we can say that nearly everyone has time to do something. So the problem is, what can he do that will help him to get rid of negative conditions in his own life? Is he disillusioned? If he is, there's a vast program that can be built to help him not to regain illusions, but to discover the good things that are facts that he has overlooked. He may be tired. He needs rest. Well, no one rests by doing nothing. People rest by changing attitudes into new fields and new opportunities, and the moment a true interest is developed, energy is there to supply it, at least in part. There may be various arts and crafts which we have had to neglect because of the pressures of economic necessities. Maybe the individual is a potential painter or sculptor. Perhaps he would make fine pottery, or perhaps he would work metals or weave or do one of many different things. But here he can develop a cultural instinct, which is very difficult to maintain during his periods of employment. In leisure, he has the opportunity to catch up on a lot of things that he has never been able to do. Now, this is a very good problem because, after all, most people who are serious thinkers have come to the conclusion that the life we live here is not the full story of our existence. If it was true, which apparently it isn't, that we are going to be judged forever as a result of the present occupations, we'd all be in terrible trouble. We wouldn't get very far unless we can grow beyond the limitation of the growth we achieve here. But if in our older years we make a very definite effort to grow, to become wiser, to be more thoughtful, to gain a new and deeper dimension of insight and understanding. The Oriental and many others in the West now would say these are the things we can take with us into the future. These are the things that can be of service to us if we come back into this world. If we do reincarnate, the things we do in the last days of life can be very important then. So regardless of what we are dedicated to philosophically or religiously, there cannot be very much criticism from anyone because we desire to grow, desire to be better, more kind, more intelligent, more generous, and more thoughtful of others. These are virtues which are respected even if they are not emulated by other people. So we can start in with the point where we are and try to find out what we can do with the 10 or 15 years of life that is left that can do more for us than anything we have ever learned in school. There's one other advantage of this that we should also take into consideration, and that is that in this post-retirement period of growth, we are able to make use of a very involved but remarkable pattern of personal experiences. We have been through a lot of things before we got to retirement. We have had various disillusionments. We have had hopes and fears. We have had responsibilities. We have made friends and, unfortunately, some enemies. We have lived in various political convictions, social convictions, orthodoxies of religious thinking. We have lived in all kinds of situations, and we have had children that got themselves into all kinds of situations and depended largely on us in some cases to get them out. With all this backlog of experience, therefore, we have the most priceless ingredient of growth. If we can sit down and rationalize what has happened to ourselves in the proper manner, we can achieve a great deal. This is more or less the contemplative discipline of Pythagoras, that we should look back upon the day, upon the year, upon the life, and determine what we have actually learned. During busy years, we probably have had the experiences, but we have never learned much from them. We had no time to rationalize them. We didn't have the incentive or the judgment to philosophize on the miseries of the day. So we went along, casting them off, blaming them on other people, regretting that we live in a benighted era, and blaming the politicians, the lawyers, the hospitals, the teachers, and everyone for the problems we have. But as we reach this period of maturity, there is a very interesting situation taking place within ourselves. The mind, weary with sophisticated thinking, begins to simplify of its own accord. Some say that this is a second childhood. Well, maybe it is. But if it is, it has the most important ingredient of childhood, namely, interest in knowing. It has become more and more evident that certain simple factual events and circumstances have dominated our experiences. So we can begin to see what was done to us as well as what was done for us by the life through which we have passed. In working this out, we have the basis of a new attitude toward religion, toward society, politics, government, everything. One of the things that the thoughtful person nearly always does learn, and is very valuable to him, is that he has always had the tendency to blame others for his troubles. It is always easy to consider other people unreasonable, even as other people consider us unreasonable. But this lack of acceptance of experience and blaming others for it is the one point that Lord Bacon very clearly pointed out, that you have to use experience honestly if you want to learn from it. Unless experience points out your own defects, your own inabilities to meet circumstances, then you have not judged it correctly. And even in retirement, experience can help us to meet the remaining years of life with an understanding that we could not gain by any book reading or by any indoctrination. Experience is on our own flesh. It is something that we cannot really get away from very far. We cannot deny it successfully. The point is to use it wisely and to find out that from experience we discover facts, whereas from inexperience we only multiply theories. So with this type of thinking, the person can start in to do something with daily living. There is a move in this direction also that does not just affect older people. There is considerable revolt among the young. Young people today feel that they are locked into an impossible situation. They are not yet tired out. They have not become so exhausted they conform as the line of least resistance. They are still a little belligerent. If they wait long enough, of course, and get enough responsibility, they too probably will fall into the current errors. But at the beginning, they really would like to do it better. The result is that there are a number of schools rising up, there are a number of individual groups taking over their own education, and there are all kinds of policies being developed to help the individual to live according to a personal standard of integrity. Now, integrity, again, is supported largely by experience. A great many of those today who are searching for more honesty in life are the ones that a few years ago were on marijuana. But they have discovered that mistake, and they have learned from that experience something that is desperately important. They are trying to straighten themselves out, realizing that the line of least resistance, the joy living that meant nothing, has gotten them into serious trouble. Little by little, experience is bringing younger people into the realization of the inadequacy of prevailing policies. Now, we don't want them to follow into another mistake, and that is through revolution and violence. What they have to do is realize the importance of changing themselves. The only way we can get at this very complicated situation successfully is that individuals take over the education of their own lives, take over the characteristics and integrities they believe to be correct. Now, it isn't hard to find these integrities if you really want to be honest. They're everywhere. And in spite of all of our negative attitudes towards the experiences of society, they are the source of instruction. They not only tell us what we should do, but they tell us what we should not do, or that we should stop doing, or that we should never have started to do. All these dimensions become apparent to us in the course of time. Now, I know from working with religious people that religious education is one of the most complicated forms of it. Religious education has never been basically integrated on a purely factual level. There seems to be no one who really doubts too seriously the law of gravity or can question the efficacy of modern physics. These things become more or less patterns of acceptance. But in matters of religion, the landmarks are rather dull or dim. The individual is not sure of things. He is not sure, for instance, that there is an integrity in life. He is not sure that there is a God, just or unjust. He does not know whether life is a rebellion against evil or a cultivation of good. He is not sure that when he passes out of here, he will have a future existence, and if so, where it will be and upon what level. These things leave a great many doubts, and answers to these doubts are not readily available. There is not some infallible source to which we can turn with absolute certainty that certain beliefs can be demonstrated scientifically, and that therefore they can become the basis of a firm, workable spiritual tradition. Well, it's not quite as bad as it looks. The only thing is, the average person hasn't looked in the right place for his facts. He must look for his facts in the very experiences of existence. Everything that we study should help us to understand why we are what we are, and if possible, what we can do about it. We must begin to recognize that there are signposts along the way. There are marks and indications that can help us. But instead of thinking of these things in terms of dogmas, we have to think of them in terms of cause and effect. We have to realize from experience, from history, from biography, from the most exact sciences up and down, from all the arts and traditions, that there are rules in life. That these rules are unchangeable, inevitable, and that these rules we must keep. And those who keep the rules get the answers. Those who break the rules do not get the answers. And if we want the answers, we have to live according to the laws. Gradually, through the very simple problem of living with each other, the rules become more or less obvious.